I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, February 9th. As the national politics media focuses primarily on the Trump impeachment trial that begins today, and yes, we will have live coverage of the proceedings beginning at 1 o'clock, the urgent business of passing the next COVID relief bill is also taking place. Tomorrow, the House Ways and Means Committee is expected to begin writing the actual bill, likely to include $1,400 checks to people with incomes of $75,000 a year or less, and phasing out gradually between $75,000 and $100,000. There would be an unemployment insurance add-on of $300 to $400 a week through August. The current $300 boost is set to expire on March 14th, so timing is crucial here. Democrats are also looking now at increasing the child tax credit to $3,600 for each child under 6 years old, $3,000 for kids 6 through 17. Now, as with the pandemic itself, lower-income people, and especially Black and Latino lower-income people, are the hardest hit. And as with many things that fall into that category, Republicans in Congress are saying everyone else can't afford the amount of spending that's being proposed to help, currently $1.9 trillion, though President Biden says he's open to negotiation on the top-line number and certain specific items. So what about housing assistance? What about aid to state and local governments so desperately needed in many states? What about money to open schools with expensive COVID protections? What about the $15 minimum wage, a permanent policy change beyond immediate COVID relief that some people want to be part of the bill? And as important as any of the particulars in this bill, why is Congress debating relief bills piecemeal every few months, rather than just pegging relief to measurable conditions in people's financial lives? Joining me now is a guest who makes a case for doing just that. She is Claudia Sahm, S-A-H-M, an economist and contributing opinion writer to the New York Times. She's a former Federal Reserve Board section chief in the Division of Consumer and Community Affairs and author of The Sahm Rule, which the Times describes as an early recession signal. Her most recent Times column is called Put the Money Printer on Autopilot. Ms. Sahm, thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on.
And let's start with this concept of putting the federal money printer on autopilot. Does that refer mainly to relief checks and extra unemployment benefits?
It can apply to many different programs that we pursue in a recession to mitigate the hardship and get us back on track. So, and we've had these kind of programs for a very long time. So unemployment insurance program is the core, what they're called automatic stabilizers. So in any recession, more people become unemployed, and so more benefits come out of that system. So that is an automatic stabilizer, and what I and several other economic policy experts have argued is we should do more of that. And the payments to people, these stimulus checks, that's one example that I've worked a lot on. But there are also enhancements to unemployment insurance, ramping up of food stamps. There's so much that we could have Congress agree outside of a recession, or, you know, any time now would be good too, to say we're going to tie it to economic conditions. I often focus on the unemployment rate. There are other ways you could do it. I absolutely think it should have something to do with our people back to work that want to work.
It's crazy in a way, Ms. Sahm, that they didn't do that in the first place. And my question is, why didn't they? Is it that Democrats and Republicans couldn't agree on what those metrics should be?
Well, it's a tough question. It's a frustrating question. And before I get into the answer, I will say for any of the listeners, even if you don't pick up the phone or tweet, my heart goes out to you if you are having trouble navigating these benefit systems, and particularly the unemployment insurance system. The deck is stacked against a lot of people depending on where they live and what kind of jobs they've had. And we're working really hard to fix that. And I've heard from many people, I'm on Twitter, and I've heard from many people, and you all are what's pushing me on, and many other experts, because this just, it shouldn't happen.
What do you hear on Twitter? What are people communicating to you that you might like to reflect back?
Yeah, I think the biggest one, and I have been very vocal, especially in the last week, about the $1,400 checks. And I think for many reasons, there half of U.S. households lost money last year. The suffering this year, the disruption is so immense. And frankly, we don't have a safety net that is built for this moment. And those who have lost jobs have, you know, I've been in conversation with some people daily. And what they tell me and why they are so fight for those checks is because they have tried for months to get their jobless benefits that have been promised to them. Maybe a spouse or a family member can't get them. And those checks, the last two in CARES and the $600 one, they went out to 90% of the U.S. population, women, men, and children. Mm-hmm. So to these unemployed, yeah, they want those jobless benefits, that extra weekly benefit, the kickback on in December, the $300 a week, that is real money. But it doesn't matter if you can't get it, even if you're eligible for it. So it's just a sign of how broken our safety net is. Unemployment insurance has been put in disrepair, sometimes actively in certain states, like Florida is one, that it's a watered down system, and it's missing people, and it's not uniform who it's missing. People of color, communities of color, young adults coming out into the workforce. I mean, you can go on and on, like mm-hmm. people who really need this. Women that have had to drop out for family responsibilities. If you drop out, if you quit your job, you don't get jobless benefits. So there's just, it's a safety net that should be and was intended. I mean, it was born in the Great Depression. Like, this was part of the New Deal, and it just hasn't been kept up. This crisis makes it clear we need it better, but they can't fix that one on the fly. So
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, we did a separate segment on Friday about women who drop out for remote learning help, for example, mm-hmm. For their kids, dropping out of the workforce. You're a Times contributing writer. Maybe you saw their section, The Primal Scream, over the weekend, which had to do with moms who are trying to work. It also covers unemployed moms, but even moms who are trying to work and how they are disproportionately affected by all this. But yes, I hear you on everything that you're saying. And before we go to the phones, here's the debate in Washington. This is why it's not bipartisan right now as much as President Biden would like it to be. And I'd like you to react to this clip of Republican Senator Pat Toomey arguing that the bill as proposed is too big in a number of ways. We'll go down some of the specifics in this minute and a half clip. He was speaking on Sunday to CNN's Jake Tapper.
The problem with this is, Jake, 42 days ago, we passed the fifth huge bill, another $1 trillion, bringing the total to over $4 trillion. Much of that money, huge amount of that money, is not even out the door yet. Much of it was way too broad and not sufficiently targeted as it was. All of these bills were passed with big bipartisan votes. The biggest of them, the CARES Act from March, over $2 trillion, not a single no vote in the entire Senate. So here we are. The economy has come roaring back. The unemployment rate is less than half what it was. Disposable income is at record highs. Savings rates are at record highs. And where we have problems is very concentrated, Jake. It's not an economy in collapse the way it was in March. Today, we have serious problems for workers in the restaurant, the hospitality, the travel and entertainment sectors. That's really a handful of places. And if those folks have fallen through the cracks of the trillions of dollars we've already spent that's been meant to help them, then let's have a conversation about how to help those folks. But nobody's making that case. What you hear is these broad generalities about, well, people are suffering, so let's spend another $2 trillion. It's not the right solution.
Again, that was Republican Senator from Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, on CNN State of the Union with Jake Tapper on Sunday. Economist Claudia Somm, contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, is with us right now, former Federal Reserve Board official. And Ms. Somm, I could tick down some of the points in that, and I will, but what jumped out at you? What would you like to respond to from that?
Well, with all due respect to Senator Toomey, he is wrong on so many points in what he just said. And a lot of it goes back to what I was talking about, the reality of our ability to help people in need. Like I said, we know from the Census Bureau, a very reputable source of information about what's happening in the economy, that half of all U.S. households lost income from work last year or since the crisis began. These numbers are from January. Like, we keep watching this, and only 20% of U.S. households have gotten any money in jobless benefits. There's a lot of reasons for that gap, but that tells you just how much need there is and how short we are falling with the systems we have in place. Now, one thing I do agree with Senator Toomey on is that there are pockets of deep, deep distress. And the service sector is one of them. I disagree that's small. I mean, my goodness, the service sector in the United States is huge, employs massive numbers of workers. And women have had to leave the labor force. Anyway, so like, I agree that there's these pockets of distress, but where I fundamentally disagree with him, and frankly, many policymakers in D.C. have had this discussion, we know there's massive need. We know some of it is more intense. We do not know on a family-by-family basis who needs that money. Like, we cannot design policy on the information we wish we had. Because
I was just going to follow up on that exact point, because he cites serious problems for workers in industries that he names. And you were just saying in general service industries, yes, you agree with him. He cites restaurant, hospitality, travel, entertainment as sectors that he calls a handful of places. But if people who work in those fields are so hard hit, and people who might be able to work comfortably at home and are still making their incomes of whatever they were, maybe they're $60,000, maybe they're $80,000 on either side of that $75,000 line, why shouldn't it be more targeted? Or are you arguing that there's just no way to actually do that?
So first of all, something like the checks, the stimulus checks, the top 10% of U.S. households by income do not get a check. They have not gotten one in this entire crisis. Those checks are targeted. The top 10% in the United States, they're kind of different like the rest of us. Well, I should say, actually, I didn't get any checks, right? So, like, there are people who shouldn't get checks, and they didn't. So it is targeted. The debate that has been live the last couple weeks is, should they be more targeted? So, we know that about 80% of U.S. households got the full checks, the population, the women, men, and children, got the full checks and CARES. They got the full checks with the $600. The discussion, what Republicans put forward about lowering the income limits from $75,000 per adult to $50,000 per adult in income, like, that would shift who would get the checks. You would move from 80% of the population having got $600, like starting in December, to 70% of U.S. households getting $1,400. That's 40 million people with a broken promise of topping it up to $2,000. And I will bet my bottom dollar that there are tens of millions of people in that 40 million who need that check and who were promised and were expecting that check. Now, it is absolutely true that there are individuals, and I've heard from some of them, who don't need this money. And I always turn back around and give them a list of 10 charities that I have donated to over this crisis, despite the fact having gotten no checks. So, I mean, I hear you. This is not a perfect system. If I could wave a magic wand, it would be unemployment insurance would be perfect. Other social safety net programs would be perfect, but I ain't got that wand. And Senator Toomey doesn't either. So, like, we have to respond to the world that we live in. And I truly believe that 80% of the U.S. population, they should be getting a $1,400 check right away. And that the next 10% from the 80th percentile to the 90th, they only get a little bit of a check. And actually, the Democrats' plan yesterday will probably narrow. Like, some people got a partial check last time, maybe won't get one this time. I think, you know, if we got to save some money, I mean, it's only like $20 billion or so, so it ain't a lot. But, I mean, if you're going to save some money, that's the way to do it. And I firmly agree, those top 10%, they didn't get a check before, and they shouldn't get one now. So
So let's take a phone call. Samantha in Queens, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Good. So I'm a single parent by choice of an 18-month-old boy. I'm 49 years old. So this was probably the worst financial decision I could have made. And I was went through my maternity leave. I'm a social worker. I worked in a hospital, had my maternity leave, but I wanted to take a little more time with my son. So I resigned, and then the pandemic hit. And so I've had no options for childcare. My mom's older and can't help. And so there are no benefits for me. And as a social worker, I understand this. You know, this has really put me into a position that anything that I've saved is being eaten away. And I'm lucky that I had a relative who died and gave me a little bit of money. But once that's gone, I could have never, as a social worker, put that kind of money aside. That's it. I'm working until, I can't imagine not working until I either get too sick or die. Because, you know, what are going to be my long-term options? Short-term, I'm going to have to start working soon, but childcare is a real issue.
So what government benefit would be appropriate to your situation? Have you thought it through like that?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, we need some kind of national child care program in this country subsidized. The fact that we don't, even working in the hospital, the child care that was available to me had I been working there was over $1,500 a week. I mean, as a social worker, there was no way I could have afforded that at the hospital. And it's really, it's amazing to me how there's this idea that we have to protect our children before they're born. But once they're born, there is no help, basically.
Right. And that's, of course, a long-term policy issue. How much of a federal child care program should there be, pandemic or no pandemic? But have you been living in uncertainty because you got the first stimulus check, but you don't know when other stimulus checks are coming and you're having to wait rather than it being triggered by your ongoing economic conditions in the way our guest is proposing, that you're having to wait for Congress to go through these partisan debates and you don't know what's coming.
And you know, if they had any sense of reality, health insurance or, you know, they get the best health insurance, they have a steady paycheck, they have all these benefits that their constituents don't have. And it's just incredible to me that they don't remember that they once came from somewhere else where maybe that wasn't, you know, the case for them. The stress is enormous, you know. I mean, the stress is enormous. Sleepless nights because I have a baby, but also sleepless nights because how do I manage this, you know? And I don't want to put that stress on him.
Samantha, I'm gonna leave it there. Thank you very much for that important and illuminating story. And good luck to you and your baby.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot. Yeah. I appreciate it.
And let me go right on to another call, and then I'll have you react to both, Musam. Patricia in Belmore, Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me. And as always, I adore this radio station, so thank you for all the work you do. I just wanted to call in and say that, you know, God bless the fact that both my husband and I are able to still at this point be working. I did take a 20% reduction in pay from my employer, and I was happy to, you know, to help and support the company as a whole in doing so. But we did receive stimulus checks and payments, and we haven't touched that money. I mean, we put it in our savings, thank God. I mean, we're still racking up credit card bills. I mean, who doesn't need the help and assistance? But I've just felt a bit guilty in receiving that because so many people don't have that work, you know, and nothing in life is for free. You know, what's going to happen when we do our tax returns? You know, like, we've received free money. That's not probable, you know. But the other point of it, too, is, you know, maybe there's an opportunity for opening a platform where people can say, okay, if I've been routed this money because we have an imperfect system, you know, maybe there's a way to, like, you know, like donation, you know, like, hey, let me return these funds to said, you know, place. So that way these funds could be allocated to shelters or to people that don't have that, you know.
Or our guest was saying before, give it to the charity of your choice.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
No, and thank you. Thank you, Ms. Somm, on either of those two callers.
Yeah, so I just want to thank both Samantha and Patricia for sharing their perspectives. And this just shows this crisis has touched so many lives, and it's touched them in different ways. So, and I guess the things with the checks, you'll hear a lot of people in D.C. is like, are they going to spend it? Is it going to, like, get the economy going? And one thing that I really appreciate about sending money to people is it empowers every single family, every single person that gets those checks to decide what they need most in this moment of crisis. And that can be, you know, paying the bills. It can be creating a buffer, setting some aside. I want to emphasize what the sacrifice, Patricia, that you're making by taking a pay cut, that's occurring across many people who are working. That has never happened en masse since the Great Depression. Like, employers are very wary to cut pay because you're doing the same work you were doing before and you get less money. And you know, it sounds like you have a family situation, you can get through this, but, you know, racking up credit card debt is tough too. But I love the fact that we give you money, you can decide what you want to do. If you go on the GoFundMe page, there are, like, heartbreaking story after heartbreaking story, but it's your money. You can decide. And I do want to emphasize, a lot of times people are like, we don't have this money, we're going to have to pay it back. First of all, the stimulus checks are not taxable. You are not going to pay taxes on those. That's a good start. And the federal government right now has the capacity to borrow, to invest in our people. We have low interest rates. The federal government is not like a family or a small business. They are the only entity in the United States. They're elected. So, I mean, we got them in Washington. They got tough decisions to make. But they can do this. They can spend this money. Now, turning to Samantha, and I think, you know,
Patricia, I'm gonna let you go now.
Yeah,
thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you, guys.
Good luck with everything.
Be well.
And turning to our first caller, and you remembered her name. Very impressive. Samantha from Queens. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think, Samantha, first of all, you know, I love that I know it's tough being home with your kid. I've got two kids. That's a very special time. They grow up fast when they're teenagers. They're a little sassy. But
you noticed that.
I think we all have. The point with paid leave is such a good one because this is a crisis. I truly believe we need to get money out to people. It's a bridge to the other side of this. Paid leave is in need now. Paid leave will always be in need. We have many women, many dads and family, like, trying to balance raising children, doing your best by them, and also contributing and working and, you know, I mean, and work at home is real work too, right? So we need to have this paid leave. And the relief bill, the $1.9 trillion package, is what's, you know, right in the big debate right now. And that's not it. The next round is a big infrastructure package, probably of the same size, you know, almost $2 trillion. And I believe, and as I advise members of Congress, that's infrastructure writ large. That's investing not just in bridges and roads, but in our people. And a system of paid leave is absolutely part of it. Shoring up the unemployment insurance system, that's a big part of it too. But paid leave and really understand the reality of what it means to be a working parent, like that. That's good for the parents. It's also good for people that work in that industry of childcare to make sure that they're paid living wages for, you know, them helping, you know, support our children and get the next generation deserves everything that we can give them.
Last question.
Okay.
In December, you wrote a column called "The Relief Bill's Biggest Blind Spot." That was about the last relief bill. How quickly we forget, because time is so compressed these days, it feels like, with all the news that takes place.
Yes.
But that last relief bill passed in December, and its lack of housing relief. So can you go into a little bit of detail about what was missing in our last minute?
Yeah, no, and I still think that housing, both people that haven't been able to pay their rent or haven't been able to keep paying their mortgage, this is a potential ticking time bomb. This is something that I'm sure is affecting many listeners in your area because New York City's got high housing costs. I applaud the fact that the eviction moratoriums, the you don't have to pay back federal mortgage, like you get a break from paying that. That's really important. But those debts have not been forgiven, right? And so the government needs to develop a plan, and they've been real busy with other, like, putting out the fire, but they have to develop a plan so that we make sure that renters and homeowners pay back, if they haven't been able to already, pay back that in a way that doesn't crush them. And we can't do like we did after the housing crisis, after the Great Recession, and leave it to banks and mortgage servicers to figure out what's good for families, right? The government needs to lead on that, and they need to put very clear guidelines and make sure that it's done right. Like I said, I don't think that conversation is really happening, especially not in public and in a way that we can talk to people out there and exactly know what they need.
And we're going to take it on in more detail in our next segment, as a matter of fact. But is it in the new bill as you see it?
There, what you keep seeing in the relief package is extensions of the eviction moratoriums and giving people longer where they don't have to pay their mortgages. This has also shown up in student loan debt. You don't have to pay the federal loans. Now, like with student loans, we know there's a big debate about just canceling the loans. I think there will have to be a real discussion about the rent that hasn't been paid, the mortgage payments that haven't come in. So it's not a live. Like right now, they just got to keep pushing it out so people don't get thrown out of their homes and their apartments. But there's a whole set of issues that are tied to housing. And that's why I flagged it in the Times. Like, I want people to be thinking about, well, how are we going to clean up this mess?
Claudia Somm, former Federal Reserve Board section chief, now a New York Times contributing opinion writer. Thank you so much for coming on with us and talking all this through.
Great. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.